I don't know what anyone else wants to talk about, and this may not be appropriate, but can
we
I just
like
say,
inappropriate. We definitely like inappropriate.
Of, it's virtues.
One of the things that is, you know, a social custom in Washington is taking out a magnifier glass and looking closely at the fine print of who got to go to a state dinner. And in this last one, I just want to say it did not take a magnifying glass to spot Mr. Bezos's partner. That was some dress, okay? Washington's easily shocked, but that was some dress.
Un-Washington. I believe that the phrase was very un-Washington.
I took note of the fact that this state dinner, because Rahm Emanuel is, of course, ambassador to Japan, this event was being described as Rahm's prom, which I
exactly.
thought was pretty good.
Well, and of course, he flew back to be in attendance and was much in evidence in Washington.
Was he hands-on, you think?
He was hanging out in the Hay Adams, I was told. Which, of course, is the Swank Hotel directly across Lafayette Square from the White House.
Do you have a source in the, bellboy staff? I wouldn't be surprised if you do.
Seems like
somebody well situated in the Hay
Adams. What a good idea.
Yeah. Okay,
no, I don't. But in fact, now that you mention it, do they even employ bellboys anymore? That's
how
the
are we going to put that on our expense account?
Reporting expenses.
Well done. Johnny Apple would have been very proud.
Exactly.
Of
well, Johnny Apple, that is another journalist tell. You know, this is like the most famous story that all journalists know, and it doesn't matter whether it's apocryphal or not, although I am assured that it is true, by the way. There are different versions of it, but Johnny Apple was the legendary big spending New York Times correspondent based at one point in London for the Times, and he has to fly at the last minute to Scandinavia for a story. He gets to Scandinavia. It's cold. What does he do? Of course, he buys a fur coat. He sends in the expense report with the fur coat, and that's too much. And they send it back, which is something that infuriates him. So he supposedly returns the expense account for the exact same amount of money overall, but minus the fur coat. And he sends a note back to New York, and the note says, find the coat.
Now, I have to say, that story, which there's versions of it over the years, he apparently disputed it in the course of a New Yorker fact check. And I may get the details wrong, but he said something like, that's preposterous. It was not fur, it was shearling, and it was off the rack. Welcome to The Political Scene from The New Yorker, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Evan Osnos, and I'm joined, as ever, by my colleagues, Susan Glasser and Jane Mayer. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, Evan.
And hi, Jane.
Hey, Evan.
There's been an astonishing series of headlines recently around an issue that we know will play a major role in this year's election. And that, of course, is abortion access and the future of reproductive rights. On Monday, Donald Trump, who has been searching for his official position on this issue, announced his latest view in a video.
Now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land, in this case, the law of the state.
Almost instantly, the very next day, we saw what this kind of approach would actually mean. The Arizona Supreme Court upheld a law banning nearly all abortions, a law, it should be noted, that dates back to 1864. When President Biden was asked what he'd say to the people of Arizona, he replied,
elect me. I'm in the 20th century, 21st century, not back then.
All of this makes us wonder, when it comes to reproductive rights in this country, what century are we living in? And looking ahead to this fall, are Democrats right that this issue may well be the fulcrum of this election? Today, we're going to take a closer look at the state of abortion law and politics and these important recent changes, plus how the issue has evolved in our lifetimes and what role it may well play this November. Susan, let's start with Trump's announcement earlier in the week. What did you make of it? Was it really a departure from his previous stances? How do you think we should regard this moment?
I mean, I'm laughing only because of the epic gaslighting, of course, in that statement, from the everybody wanted row thrown out to the different positions that Trump has espoused. Let's just say this. First of all, we are living in the world that Donald Trump wrought. And that is a world in which Roe versus Wade was thrown out by the Trump majority Supreme Court not quite 2 years ago. That has reshaped politics, really, in some very important and profound ways. Abortion was not the major voting issue back in the 2020 presidential election, 2016. For decades, it's been a fervent source of activism and organizing and, you know, focus of a part of the American right wing, the very almost laser-focused anti-abortion movement that took decades with the goal in mind of repealing Roe versus Wade. Well, Donald Trump now has this, what I might call, catastrophic success on his hands. He fulfills this promise to the hard right of his party when he gets elected. Donald Trump used to be what he himself said was, quote, very pro-choice. He's had more positions on abortion than answers on a multiple choice test. And yet he made this bargain. He transformed the Supreme Court. They throw out Roe versus Wade. And now he's in a political bind. And I think it's really summed up by Arizona this week.
We'll talk about the Arizona law in just a second. But Jane, what did you make of his announcement? Is this, in fact, some position that appeals to any portion of America that we have not yet identified?
I think it's a statement that appeals to Donald Trump because he's trying desperately to get out of taking responsibility for the situation that he's left the country in. And so he's trying to make it sound reasonable that it's somebody else's choice, not his. But listen, let's take a look at how we got here. This was, in 2016, the result of a deal that was made between Donald Trump, who was about to be probably not elected thanks to the opposition from the evangelical Christians and Catholic right that regarded him as a non-godly person who had poor moral standards. And so he cut a deal. And the deal that he cut in 2016 was with the Federalist Society, which is a dark money group with secret funding that is not disclosed. And the particular figure that he dealt with was Leonard Leo, a very, very canny political operative who is himself a very conservative Catholic. And the deal they struck was Donald Trump got the support of the religious right in exchange for basically outsourcing the Supreme Court, a third branch of the U.S. government, to an outside group that picked who the justices were going to be. That's what we're dealing with. And it brought on the religious voters and mobilized them to turn out. And here we are.
So we'll talk a little more about that movement in a second. But I just on the Arizona issue, because I think it's important to try to lay out what the implications could mean politically in the short term. Susan, you know, one of the things Trump did afterwards when he was kind of trying to wriggle out of this predicament politically is he said, well, he said, we're going to, quote, get it straightened out.
yeah, that didn't work out.
Right, exactly. Republicans in the Arizona legislature blocked efforts by Democrats to actually repeal the law. So right now it is a matter of law. What do you think the implications are for Arizona politics, which has some important races this fall?
Well, you know, Evan, I think the implications for Arizona politics are absolutely enormous. And you had even many Republican strategists in the state calling this an earthquake, absolutely disastrous for Republican candidates on their ballot at the state level, and also potentially a very big boost to Biden in the state. Let's remember that Arizona is one of a very small handful of states in the country that is really genuinely a battleground. In 2020, Joe Biden won the state by 10,500 votes. So, you know, about as close as you could imagine. Now, recently, what I've been hearing from many operatives is real concern on the part of Democrats that Arizona was slipping away from them. That has all changed, I think, this week.
Wow.
Arizona is certainly back in play in a big way. There's a sense that it really is going to boost turnout and enthusiasm among Democratic voters. Surveys suggest that not only is Arizona quite pro-choice, but also that they would be motivated to come out and vote. And that's, you know, it's also a story, I think, Evan, about women's reproductive rights, but it's, and healthcare. But it's also a story about the dysfunction of our electoral politics and our institutions. Mm. You mentioned how the Republican legislature did not, quote, fix it the way that Donald Trump was sort of hoping they would and get it off his plate. They have like a one seat majority in the in the state legislature. And so when people like Donald Trump say in his statement, well, this is just about the will of the people and states' rights and we're going to let the people decide, it's a fundamentally anti-democratic and undemocratic movement in many states that has led to the dismantling of women's rights. And I think that that really gets at the heart of why men and women are going to be motivated to vote on this issue.
I think that's a very good point. And part of the, again, it comes back to the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has enabled the gerrymandering of these states. And in many of the states, there are these supermajorities that reflect extreme points of view and not at all the view of all the voters. So you have to look at a place like Ohio, for instance, which where the legislature is far more right-wing than the population is. And the Supreme Court enabled that. And then you take a look at what's happened in Arizona. How did we get that Supreme Court that is so far right wing? Well, one of the first things the Republicans did when they took over the state politics was they packed the Supreme Court. They enlarged it from 5 members to 7. So all over the country, this is going on, where you are seeing very anti-democratic moves by those in power who are frequently extremists who are just locking in their ability to jam these policies down everybody else's throats.
Well, and what I find interesting is this question of what is the backlash going to be? And in Arizona, for example, where the previous Republican governor packed the court, actually, a couple of those justices, the way it now works is they have to then face the voters. Those are then elected justices. And, you know, there are some Arizona commentators who see the possibility now that they would get both a Democratic state legislature and change the balance of power on the state Supreme Court and, of course, possibly affect the federal races, both for members of Congress. There's a Senate race on the ballot and there's, of course, this presidential race on the ballot. All of that could be in play because of this one decision by the Arizona Supreme Court. And so it's kind of the politics of backlash, right? Again, catastrophic success. Did you abuse the powers that you had when these Republicans came into office, and are voters going to respond to that this November?
Well, and I think you can't get out of this discussion without mentioning, of course, the fact that Florida also had big news. I mean, it already feels like ancient history, but it was just the other day where the Supreme Court in that state did two things. One, it cleared the way for a ban after 6 weeks of pregnancy. But the court also said that it will be on the ballot this fall. And that's a big deal, as we will talk about in a minute, the implications. But let's take a break first. When we come back, how the debate about reproductive health has evolved to the point where it is today, and what are the forces that are driving that change?
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
When Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022, it was the culmination, as we've hinted at, of really decades of work and planning and investment among anti-abortion advocates. And the decision was obviously at the time and continues to be at odds with the majority of American opinion. Polls show that they largely disapprove of Roe being overturned. And I think, Jane, one of the things that often kind of people are trying to get their head around is, what was the key to the anti-abortion movement's success? Was it money? Was it intensity? Was it, you know, a single unifying issue that was able to draw people from multiple places in the politics? Was it sheer patience and strategy? How do you've been thinking and researching this for a long time? How do you think about it?
Can I just say yes to all of the above? It was all of those things. But, you know, in a way, what I think it is if you really go back to the very beginning, it was a very smart and in some ways political alliance that was struck between the old Republican Party of sort of Wall Street and business that was not winning, as even back, I saw a quote that was great from Paul Weyrich, who was one of the early architects of all of this. He's a, you know, very, very important conservative architect of the conservative movement. And he said, you know, capital formation was not bringing out the voters. They were not winning on the oligarchs issues. They needed to get people out in the streets and into the voting booths. And the anti-abortion movement was, he called it, I think, the greatest untapped virgin forest in American politics. Mm. There were all these people who had religious feelings about it, who were not voting. And if you could get them to vote, you might be able to win as a Republican, even with very unpopular policies on business and sort of class issues. And so they struck an alliance. And it took a while before it really came together. And for a long time, the issue was really considered kind of one of those kind of slightly embarrassing issues for mainstream Republicans. So when I covered Reagan, for instance, there was a huge anti-abortion rally, but he didn't want to be actually joining those crowds. He didn't go and speak to it in person. He did a remote speech from his desk in the Oval Office, even though they were just practically outside of his door. But he didn't want to be in person with these sort of slightly, you know, too fervent people. Eventually, though, by 2004, with the reelection of George W. Bush, at that point, you really see that it becomes an overt strategy of Karl Rove. They went out very deliberately for what they called the Catholic vote. And they really tried to mobilize these voters, and they brought them in, and they became a tremendously important part of the Republican coalition. Wow. And eventually, the religious right said, pay up. Where are our judges?
Well, look, I think this was, as Jane said, like a decades-long thing. And the 1980s, we kind of forget this, but it really, abortion politics was one of the dominant domestic issues. And I mean, I remember when I was in college, this was one of the defining domestic political issues. And there was a great fear at that time that the Supreme Court was going to overturn abortion. In fact, when I was a senior in college, there was a big abortion rights march here in Washington, D.C., and there hundreds of thousands of people came because there was a fear that the Supreme Court was going to overturn it. But then it turned out that a number of Republican appointees were not ready to do that. You had Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was kind of this fulcrum. And so what happened is, I think we could have had something like this happen a couple decades ago. But what's amazing is that the Republican Party gradually got more and more taken over. And I think what you had is the fusion of this incredibly important base. Something like when Trump was elected in 2016, I think white evangelical Christians were something like the highest percentage voting bloc for Trump and the Republican presidential ticket, something like 80%. That was true again in 2020. And you also had this confrontational style. Remember, this is the age of the Tea Party and the Freedom Caucus, and these things sort of came together in the culmination, you could say, of this movement and years of organizing. And what I'm interested in is how they're now fighting among themselves. And I think Trump is trying to navigate that, not very successfully, by the way. Like, look at Mike Pence. He picked Mike Pence as his vice president, in a way, as an envoy to those people, to reassure kind of the evangelicals who were such an important part of the Republican Party, like, okay, fine, he's a kind of thrice divorced vulgarian, but, you know, don't worry, we're going to make this deal with you and the deal's going to stick. Well, this week, Mike Pence came out after Donald Trump's statement and he called it a, quote, slap in the face. Why? Because the truth is, although this kind of conservative legal movement has been shouting about states' rights for years, in reality, now that they've won the repeal of Roe versus Wade, many of them want to not go for states' rights and they want a federal law banning abortion across the board. That's what Mike Pence represents. Donald Trump, he got Trump in the White House to endorse that. People forget this. Yeah. But when Donald Trump was in the White House, he actually issued a statement saying that he would sign a national abortion ban at 20 weeks gestation. Now, it didn't pass through Congress, so it never came to his desk. But now Trump is trying to say, okay, well, let's just have the states do it so we'll have some kind of crazy patchwork of laws in this country where if you're in a red state, you can't get an abortion. If you're in a blue state, you can. And I think this is a fight that they're going to be navigating for a number of years.
Well, it's also, I mean, it just, for the people who really care about this issue and think abortion is murder, murdering someone at 15 weeks is no better than murdering them, you know, at 6 weeks. It's an all or nothing group of people. Mm. We're talking about people who have very fervent, extreme views. And Trump is just trying to buy them off in his usual transactional way. But there's not a deal to be cut that is going to make the far, far right, you know, feel fine about that.
Conversely, for women, too. I mean, you know, for Democrats, it's the same issue, which is that states' rights is a completely unacceptable way forward. If reproductive freedom is a right in this country, then your rights should not depend on whether you live in Austin, Texas, or in California.
Absolutely. But while we're talking about how we got there, I have to say that another piece of this that doesn't get talked about that much is really that the Democrats sort of sleepwalked through lots of this.
In what sense? What do you mean? Why?
If you go back and even look at 2016, actually, Hillary Clinton gave a terrific speech about the Supreme Court being in the balance and how important it was because of Roe. And she's a lawyer, and she framed it really well. I went back and took a look at it, and it made almost no news. It could barely cut through the sort of Donald Trump obsession kind of coverage. And the Democratic Party didn't really pick it up and keep hammering it. You know, this was at a period when Merrick Garland had been blocked and that seat was open. It was very clear that it hung in the balance. But the Democratic Party did not really make it a major issue in the 2016 campaign.
Yeah, I think that in hindsight, Jane, it's really, you know, notable because, of course, it's always easier to organize before a catastrophic outcome has occurred. And right now, if Republicans are divided over their way forward, I think Democrats are too, frankly. I mean, here we are already 2 years after the decision throwing out Roe, and there's not really a consensus. I think what there is, and we'll talk about this more, but there's more of a consensus that this is a good political issue for Democrats than there is a consensus on how to secure women's reproductive freedom.
I mean, I actually think it's easier to organize after there's a catastrophic event. I mean, seriously, I think what's happened is that—
No, it's easier to organize, but my point is that it would have been easier to deal with this problem while you still have to
love on the book. Failure of imagination at the point. People just didn't think it could or would.
Well, that's
happen.
The question. I mean, I'm curious, Jane. I mean, do you really think, when you were sort of put yourself in your mind of 10 or 15 years ago, did you think that this could actually happen, that Roe v. Wade could be overturned?
I'll tell you what I thought when I just remember this conversation so well at a very, very elegant Washington dinner party with a lot of very important and smart people. And they sort of said the Dobbs decision hadn't yet come down and Trump had not been elected yet. And people said, well, do you think like it would really matter if they overthrew Roe? And I said, 100%. Are you kidding? This is going to, you know, being female, you have a very strong feeling about this issue often. And I certainly do. And all these guys around the table were like, oh, I don't know. I really think to a certain extent, this is an issue that an awful lot of male political consultants did not understand or feel in their guts the way women do. And women have come out and voted in a way that I would have predicted, but I think a lot of people didn't see it.
Jane, I really want to echo that. A few years ago, for me, the issue really hit home when, remember that the Supreme Court over time was already chipping away at these rights and giving more and more leeway to the states to pass ever more restrictive laws. And there was a debate in Oklahoma, very conservative state, very conservative state legislature, and they were working on passing a very restrictive state law. And they started debating in the committee various measures that they would include in this law. And some of these male state legislators wanted to include the idea that even an ectopic pregnancy is somehow an abortion, as if there was ever any kind of a viable pregnancy there. And when I was based in Moscow, I had an ectopic pregnancy. I nearly died in Russia. I had to be evacuated by air to London. I was speaking just the other day with a friend of ours who is a doctor who's involved in this kind of medicine. And she said to me, I told her this story, and she said, and if you had been in Oklahoma, Susan, you would have died.
There you go.
You would have died.
I mean, and we, you know, I mean, that's an incredible story, but it's not atypical. Any woman, and probably most men, if they take the time to ask, knows somebody who's gone through some kind of incredibly difficult physical situation that could even be life-threatening, having to do with reproductive issues. And we all know this. We also know the history of how many women died in childbirth before all contraception and abortions were available.
You know, I do think that we'll talk about the politics of it, but it's beyond politics. This is an example of where the hot air meets the road, where we're not just talking about Donald Trump and his flood of BS and words. We're talking about like real consequences to the broken nature of our political system.
I just have to say that abortion is not even just about reproductive rights for women. It's an equality issue because it's about giving women sort of some power over planning their lives, their professional lives, their family lives, just putting them in a sort of an equal position of power. And I think, you know, for all these reasons, as you guys have been saying, it is just an incredibly important issue to voters. And it's why in red states, one after the next, women have turned out and surprised the political sort of establishment by pushing back restrictions on abortion.
Well, and I think to the question of health and people who are having, as Susan described in that extraordinary story, an emergency. I mean, one of the things that is a fact about this Florida Supreme Court decision is that it now means that pretty much the entire South is a place in which you are unable to get any kind of reproductive health. You have to drive now, in some cases, hundreds or thousands of miles. It used to be that people were coming from Georgia and other states that had these very restrictive policies and were coming to Florida. And as a result of the Supreme Court decision, that's no longer possible. And of course, it will be on the ballot in the fall. After 6 months under that new state of affairs, voters will have a chance to change the law. And we're going to talk about that and the national implications in just a second.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Susan, we've been talking a lot about how the right has been organizing and handling this moment. How do you think the Biden administration has responded to the rulings in Arizona and Florida?
You know, Evan, when the news gods give you an opening, you need to be prepared to take it. It strikes me that the Biden campaign has been very prepared to jump on this in some ways. I think both Biden's campaign and Trump's campaign understand that this abortion issue might be the issue that helps to reelect the president. And, you know, I think of our conversation that we were just having here about how much it resonates with real Americans in a way that many other political issues don't. And one of the things that the Biden campaign did this week that I was really struck by is they immediately after Trump's statement, they released an ad that had clearly already been in the works for some time, a 1-minute ad. It's a young couple based in Texas who recount in very intimate, personal way how they had a similar story to mine, actually.
This is just filled with some of the things that we had started gathering for her while I was pregnant.
It was a woman who had a miscarriage.
This is
Hi.
the blanket that she was in.
She was sent home instead of getting that care. She got an infection. She landed back in the hospital with sepsis. She nearly died. And as a result, she may also no longer be able to have children.
It's okay. No.
I defy you to watch this ad without crying. It's a very powerful ad. And at the end, the ad fades to black. And over the sound of the woman crying, this tagline, Trump did this. Trump did this. And, you know, I think that's what we're gonna see, millions and millions of dollars worth of ads like that, both nationally and in targeted states such as Arizona. We're having this conversation on Friday. Vice President Harris, who's been the administration's point person ever since Roe was thrown out on the issue. She's flying out for an event in Tucson. You had Biden himself cut an ad where he did a voiceover that was aimed at Arizona voters. The strategy that we're seeing both in this battleground state and around the country is to try to put referendums that explicitly put abortion rights on the ballot. Now, not all the battleground states are going to have these referenda. For example, Michigan already had one. It won overwhelmingly in the midterm elections. But what it means is not going to be on the ballot this fall. The two really battleground states where it looks likely, it's not yet approved, where it looks likely to have these referenda on the ballot are in Arizona and in Nevada. And those two states alone could end up deciding the election.
What about Florida, Jane?
Well, there will be a referendum in Florida. We know that. But I think that the word that I
but
hear is
But it's not
that,
a battleground state.
Well, that's
an interesting question.
That is the question. I mean, and the word on the street is that the Democratic Party is not well organized there and that the odds are overwhelmingly against Biden carrying Florida. But it actually could have quite an effect, I think, on down ballot races, maybe even the Senate race. And so, I mean, it has the ability to really get voters out at a time when there's not that much excitement about Biden, but there is really deep feeling about this particular issue.
Yeah, I remember when I was reporting on Biden and his response to this issue, particularly to the Dobbs verdict, one of his aides had said to me, you know, this has been famously, historically, abortion has been a really hard issue for him because he's a Catholic. He's never been particularly comfortable talking about it. Abortion rights activists take note of the fact he doesn't like to even use the word abortion very often. But as this person said, after the Dobbs verdict, this became an easy issue for him. In some ways, it kind of gave him a new framework in which to talk about it. And one of the ways that they talk about it is under the heading of freedom and saying that this is a way in which the, as they would say, MAGA Republican movement is determined to take away your freedoms. And I think that this is a place in which there are Democrats who say, look, I don't agree with Joe Biden even on his stance on abortion in some ways, because there are a lot of advocates who want to go further than he does. When he says he wants to restore Roe v. Wade, they say, well, Roe v. Wade itself was antiquated. We want to go further and enshrine more protections. But so far, and I think this is an important nuance, that you have not seen them come out publicly and say, we are not going to support Biden, because the alternative here is so resoundingly clear, and the alternative is Donald Trump and election bans.
You know, Evan, you've been following the White House very closely. Do you think this is an issue that really will help Kamala Harris raise her political profile and support for her?
It is a real moment, an issue on which she has passion, credibility, and now a strategy. I think that's important to point out, because there has been, as we know, this long period in which people say, well, what is she doing in the job? What is her role in that administration? And that role is becoming clearer and clearer by the day. I mean, this is a position that you'll hear more from her about. And that's important, because this election involving an 81-year-old president is more so than we've seen in recent years, also about the vice president. And this is a chance for her to distinguish herself. And I think people are watching closely to see how that goes.
It's an interesting question, because she is the most active kind of administration speaker and surrogate on this. But there is sort of a question about what, you know, has she really done? Because the strategy, right, is a state-driven strategy. The strategy is activist groups getting these referendums on the ballot, using it to goose turnout. Interestingly, to Evan's point, on the freedom thing, I did notice that this ad that they cut for Biden in Arizona was it didn't really talk about abortion. It talked about freedom. It used that language, and it said casting it forward, what freedoms might they take away next? And I think that's kind of the palpable edge and fear and looking forward on this issue. There's the Supreme Court concurring opinion in the Dobbs v. Jackson case, which suggested from Clarence Thomas, we're coming for your gay marriage, we're coming for your contraception, that we're not going to stop with abortion.
Because those decisions were similarly based on the idea that the Constitution guarantees a right to privacy. And Clarence Thomas has been withering in his contempt for that idea.
Well, and I'll tell you, when I spoke to President Biden about it, he brought this up very deliberately, very specifically. I mean, that is his theory of the case, is that that's where they will go next. And I asked him, I said, do you think that there is enough on the court right now, enough people who agree with that to undo it? And he said, well, probably not a majority, but I think some people on the court are certainly determined to do it. He said, particularly that guy who loves yachts. And I said, Thomas.
Well, you know, the other thing going forward, I'm curious what both of you think about this. So one of the things on the agenda we've already talked about, which is a kind of passing a national abortion ban through Congress. That seems like a stretch, politically speaking. But the other thing that Republicans are talking about is basically pulling an Arizona on a national level and reviving an anachronistic, archaic law called the Comstock Act as a way to ban abortion at a federal level. Do either of you think that that's a viable strategy for the Republicans?
I mean, certainly, this is what, if you look at the Project 2025, the sort of blueprint that's being put together by the Heritage Foundation and other right-wing groups, this is something that they are discussing. Comstock Act passed in the 1870s. It was an effort to try to criminalize anything to do with abortion that would go through the federal mail, like, you know, mailing any kind of implements or anything else. And what they want to do is revive it to apply to medical abortions so that nobody can take pills to have, like, morning after pills or anything like that. I think that's very much on the agenda and should be taken very seriously.
Well, Jane, I mean, I think one of the things that drives home that is such an important point is I think some people think of the Dobbs decision as, okay, that was the end of a chapter. No, no, this is a live and open matter. And in fact, things could very well get even worse. And that may not be an issue that I think voters who are disengaged or are not feeling all that enthusiastic about Joe Biden may not really know that much about. I mean, I think one of the tasks for Democrats over the next few months is to bring this issue in the way that you just did, Jane, to make this vivid and to say, hey, this is a forward-looking issue. In fact, this is not retrospective.
So it may not be that we're in 1864. We're just going to be in the 1870s, or maybe some combination of the two.
Well, the point is, like many of the great historically divisive issues in American politics, it strikes me that it's very unlikely that it really is going to be resolved in a state-by-state level of kind of endless circular debates. That this is why we have a national legislature. This is why we have a Congress. And that ultimately, while there's no consensus, there is going to be division and a kind of roiling period in our politics around this. I think that, you know, I heard Donald Trump say this week, states' rights, states' rights, states' rights. And I have to say, I thought, you know, whoever was advising him, I don't know, had been like hiding out in some kind of a Southern golf club for the last, you know, 50 years, thinking that this was a magic bullet out. And, you know, just as the Supreme Court decision in 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education, it's got to be a national decision ultimately. We cannot have a world in which more than half of the country's population's health care and basic human rights depends upon where the heck they happen to live. That's insane. I don't think it's sustainable. I think that this is an issue that is going to power our politics for a long time to come, because it strikes me ultimately unsustainable for a a national, unified country to have a situation where women's rights depend on what state they happen to live in?
I mean, I think it stands to potentially unravel the coalition that was put together all those years ago in the Republican Party. And I think it's a very threatening issue to the Republican Party at this point. And you can see that that's what Trump's afraid of.
Well, there's no better way to end it for today. We're going to continue on this topic in the future, no question. But I'm just grateful to both of you for how much work you've been doing on this, thinking about it, working on it, writing about it. And it's a pleasure to talk to you about it. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Evan.
All right. Great to be with you guys.
This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. I'm Evan Osnos. If you have thoughts on the show or questions, please send them to us at themail@newyorker.com. And don't forget to include The Political Scene in the subject line. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia and Dan Richards, with editing by Gianna Palmer. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Condé Nast's head of global audio is Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. We'll be back next week. Thank you so much for listening.
From PRX.